Tonight, please help me welcome from Bedminster, New Jersey, Chris S.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's good to be here. Good to be here tonight. It's been about 7 years or so since I've been here. Glad to see everybody's hanging in. Want to thank Bob and Ruth for driving me out here. It's always fun to have some company on the way. Lauren for texting and keeping me apprised of the addresses and everything. I appreciate it. I love that we read this set aside prayer here tonight. My understanding of where the set aside prayer came from came out of the Denver group, and there were some people in the Denver group who always, they were the type of people who, I got this, or I know, or yeah, but, you know, there were those kind of guys, and this guy Dom P was sponsoring him, finally he got to the point where he said, look, you really need to start praying for an open mind. You need to set aside, you need to ask God to help you set aside your old ideas and all the things that you think you know, because it's the things that you think you know that can get you in trouble. And that gave a couple of guys the idea to develop this. It's actually the lay aside prayer. And I think it's really important because, especially when there's an educational component or it's a step meeting or a big book meeting where hopefully you're going to gain some information that you can turn into a recovery experience. It's good to be open-minded. It's good to be able to be teachable. I remember when I was first coming around, there was a couple of people in the groups that, you know, their sponsor told them a couple of things. They went to a couple of meetings, and that's all they needed to know, like the rest of their lives. And these were some cranky people, there were some cranky AA members. As long as I stay open-minded, as long as I stay willing to learn and to consider things that might go a little bit at odds from what I think I know, I think that there's a chance I'm gonna broaden and deepen, you know, my relationship with God, my fellow man, and I'll continue to be able to trudge down this road of happy destiny. I am an alcoholic. I know what alcoholism is today. And the funny thing was, when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, admitting I was an alcoholic, I didn't even know what I was admitting. I thought, if you would have asked me in my first month in AA, if you would have sat me down and said, Chris, I want you to define an alcoholic, my definition would have been something like this. Oh man, they drink too much. You know, that's about all they get in trouble, they drink too much, they get DUIs. Well, you know, what I know today is there's a lot of people that drink too much. There's a lot of people that get in trouble behind alcohol. There's a lot of people that get DUIs that are nowhere near alcoholic. They're just idiots, you know? So I understand what alcoholism is today. I really, really do. At its absolute simplest, I have a mind that won't let me leave alcohol alone and a body that cannot tolerate it. You know, at its simplest, that's what alcoholism is. And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I want to wrap it around my understanding today of step one. All right. I'm one of the guys that believes that I was alcoholic before I started drinking. And, you know, I'll explain why. One of my first memories is, My mother coming into the room and saying, hey, you know, get dressed, get ready. Today's your first day of kindergarten. And I'd heard about this kindergarten thing, right? I'd heard about it, you know. I knew it was coming. And so, you know, I got dressed and I went out to the car. We drove across town. She opened up the door. She said, there's the classroom. I'll be back later for you, and drove away. I'm like 5 years old. I'm standing up on this hill and I'm looking down. And all the kids are already having fun. They're playing tag and kickball and, you know, they're already friends. They've assimilated. You know what I mean? And I'm standing up on the hill looking down, and the waves of self-centered fear, the waves of feeling separate, feeling apart from, not thinking I'm going to fit in, you know, thinking I'm going to do something that's going to embarrass myself. I'm thinking, who the hell came up with this kindergarten thing? You know, this is not going to work for me. You know, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do it under protest. And I walked down the hill and I did what was expected of me. And literally for the next 7 years, I had the same feelings of just turbo uncomfortable in school situations. I hated it. All right. I did not like it. I always was staring out the window or at the exit sign. I did not want to be here. I didn't want to be with you. There's something else that's got to be better than this. Now, you know, why am I talking about this? Because what would have helped a great deal my first day at kindergarten would have been a half a pint of vodka. Think about it, you know. I'm not feeling good, real comfortable about this, you know. Half a pint of vodka, yeah, you know. I'd have been the kindergarten kid. I'd have been all over it. You'd have been lucky to pick me for your team, you know. I mean, because alcohol does something for me. Now, alcohol does something to anybody that drinks it. You know, you drink a quart of vodka, you get pulled over, you're going to get a DUI. You know what I mean? Alcohol gets you drunk. But what it does for alcoholics is it's healing to us. It takes care of an inner condition that sets us apart and away from God and our fellow man. Now, I'll explain how that looked with me the first time I drank. Me and a couple of my buddies decided we were going to cut school and we were going to go to my house and we were going to get drunk, you know, because it was a very cool thing we thought to do. And that's what we did. We're about 13 years old. We go back to my house, we cut school. And I pull a bottle of Four Roses whiskey out of the closet and blow the dust off of it and pour three big water glasses of Four Roses whiskey. Okay, let's get drunk. And warm Four Roses whiskey out of a water glass is not the way to go. I would learn that later. But so we start drinking. Now what happened to my two buddies who never became alcoholic, never became problem drinkers, to my knowledge? They drank about two-thirds of their glass and they called it quits. You know, that was about enough for them. But what happened to me was immediately the phenomenon of craving, the allergy to alcohol, kicked in and I got drunk out of my mind. I got blackout drunk. I'm 13 years old. Any blackout drinkers in here? A lot of hands. Isn't it disconcerting, like, you know, coming to in a different town, you know, wearing one shoe, you know, and not knowing what happened? You know, that kind of stuff just does not happen to normal people. But so I went into a blackout and I came to in a field, and then I was sick. I was deathly ill for about 2 days. You know, your first really bad hangover, you just want to die. And the whole time I'm going through this hangover thing, right, I'm thinking, I'm going to do this a lot. Yeah. Now, where did that come from? Where did that come from? Like, this is not the last time I'm going to drink alcohol. and I'm deathly ill. Where does that come from? Well, it came from here. You remember the kindergartner with all that anxiety and tension and just, you know, feeling just beyond uncomfortable. That alcohol took that away. And I remember just the feeling of, you know, like everything is okay. I'm in the right place at the right time with my two new best friends, you know, and this is great, you know, and this is cool. And it just, I was free. And that's what alcohol did for me. Everything that was wrong was made right. Do you know what I mean? And alcohol did not do that to the two other dudes that I was drinking with. They just sat back and watched the show because I was completely out of control. Now I knew at least this much, not to drink Four Roses whiskey anymore. But, you know, I knew that I had to find a way to drink alcohol. I needed to do that. And if anybody remembers the fine selection of Boone's Farm products, remember those, you know? Strawberry Hill and apple wine, you know? My God. That stuff it was like Kool-Aid and grain alcohol or something. I would get that stuff. I started drinking beer. You know, moved up to blackberry brandy and Southern Comfort, you know. It's what you drink when you're like 14, you know, Southern Comfort. It's like Cairo syrup and alcohol. So I became very preoccupied with alcohol, and I started drinking it when I could. I started to think, when am I going to get a chance to drink it? How am I going to, you know, drinking age was 21. I was 13. Was problematic, but not insurmountable. You know what I mean? For someone who had wits about themselves. So where was I going to drink it? Who was it going to be with? How much would I get? I started to program myself for this drinking. And folks, that's not what the non-alcoholics were doing. I mean, they weren't going through in their mind, you know, how many beers they were going to need to have until 11 o'clock at night or something, you know. But I was really preoccupied with this stuff. And as time went on, because alcoholism is progressive, as time went on, you could have seen the graph of how many ounces of alcohol I was putting in my body on a weekly basis, and then it became daily, and you could see my alcoholic progression. I needed more and more and more, and somewhere you cross the line. I don't know where it is. The tragic thing about when you cross the line into full-blown alcoholism is you've crossed the line before alcohol gets your attention enough that you want to separate from it. You know, that's why so many of us die. That's why so many of us relapse. We cross the line into powerlessness. Now, this is something that it took me a long time to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. This goes fundamentally against everything that's built into our system. Our egos reject this idea out of hand. But this is what the big book says. That we are without defense against the first drink. That's what powerlessness is. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but the times that I swore off and then I got drunk again, or the times I relapsed or whatever, you know, I wanted to own that. Like I screwed up. You know, I drank because she left. But the fact of the matter is I drank when she stayed. You know what I mean? Or I drank because I lost the job. But the truth of the matter was I drank when I got a good job. It's not causal. You know, we want it to be causal. And we want to attach our will to it. But what the big book says is we are without defense against the first drink. Which means we are powerless. Folks, how much power is powerless? It's right up there with not a hell of a lot. You know what I mean? Now think about this. If I am admitting powerlessness like the first step asks me to do, it's this bad. I have absolutely no say whether alcohol is going to go back in my body. Absolutely no say. I'm not even going to be there when it goes back in my body. I mean, that's what the big book is saying. We will be slamming the bar, asking ourselves, how the hell did we get started again? You know, and this has been my experience, and this is what happened. All right, I had signed myself into a treatment center. It's early 1989. It's ugly. My life is painful. Painful, you know, with the amount of alcohol that I'm drinking and decadent and lonely and emotionally overwhelming. And I understand that alcohol is somewhere in this mix and I need to quit drinking it. So I sign myself into a treatment center. Voluntarily, I walk into a treatment center, 28 days. They say go to outpatient and AA. When I got out, I went to outpatient, I went to AA, and I got to tell you, if there was a meter for people, you know, I don't want a drink meter, I'd have beat anybody in the AA rooms that I was going to. I didn't want to drink more than anybody in any of the AA meetings that I was in. I can guarantee you that. And on the way to an AA meeting one day, the thought crossed my mind that, you know, I could probably be doing a better job with this AA thing. I'll tell you what, if I bought a gallon of vodka and I drank it, it would do a couple of things. It would remind me why I don't drink. And, you know, I would come running back into AA, you know, like with a lot more horsepower than I have right now. So, sounds like a plan. So I buy a gallon of vodka and I start to drink it. And somewhere in the third glass, I recognize the enormity of my mistake. The cage door of the beast is going to open up and he's just going to move me around like a puppet for however long, you know, the alcohol beast is just going to move me around the planet for however long that's going to happen. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't go running back into AA. I was now locked back in to this alcohol cycle, and it took me another 7 months to be able to separate again. Now, think about this. I really didn't want to drink. I signed myself into a treatment center to not drink. I was going to outpatient to not drink. I was going to AA to not drink. And I drank. You know, what is that? It talks in our book about insanity. Insanity. The strange mental blank spots that precede the first drink. The subtle forms of insanity that precede the first drink. And this is something that took me a long time to understand. I understood when I would start drinking, I'd be in it and I'd get blotto drunk every time. I understood that, but I never understood that I had no choice. I had no choice, no power, no control. That's what the first step was saying to me. So, it's Christmas 1989. I'm at my mother's house. My brother and sister are there for Christmas. Nieces, nephews, the whole shebang. You know, the Christmas trees and the Christmas carols and the stockings are hung by the chimney with care. You know, the whole thing. And I go into a drunken blackout and I threaten my entire family. I'm going to kill all of you because somebody said something. You know how they are. They'll say something, you know, what did you say, you know, and so literally, I mean, I very seriously threatened all of their lives, and that wasn't the festive mood that everyone was looking for. So I come out of this multi-day blackout, like, I was gone 4 days into this blackout. And I come out of it, you know, and I'm shattered. And I remember going into the kitchen because what you used to have to do is turn the water on and like drink out of the faucet for like 3 minutes, you know, to try to rehydrate. And I couldn't do it because of these vodka bottles in the sink. There was probably 20 vodka bottles I didn't remember buying. I mean, that must have been a scene, you know, like the liquor store was like 3 blocks away. I could just picture myself making it to the liquor store because I'd only buy one bottle at a time because I might quit. I don't want to be stuck with it. Unnecessary inventory, you know what I mean? So I could just see myself, you know, staggering up the street, you know, 20 times a day for a bottle of vodka. Anyway, you know, I come out of this and what I did, folks, what I did was I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I had a willingness that was born of desperation this time. And it wasn't that I was afraid of dying. You can't scare us by saying you're gonna die. Like if you keep drinking, you're gonna die an alcoholic death. You know, the doctor says to you, well, how much time do I got, doc? You know, and can you be a little bit more descriptive about that alcoholic death? I need more information on that. You know, well, you can't scare us. But what did scare me was I could be the type of person that could come out of a blackout having killed my family. That was a bridge too far for me, too far. And, you know, I stopped drinking, I started praying, and it was a brutal detox, about 3 or 4 days, just hallucinating and fish flopping. It was a mess. And off to Alcoholics Anonymous I went. Now, understand that I didn't know if AA was going to work. You know, I was like back into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was hoping against hope that maybe Alcoholics Anonymous would have some kind of a solution for me. You know, it didn't work before. Why would I think it's going to work now? But I don't have a better plan. So off to AA I go. So I want to be clear on step one before I move to step two. Step one is, the allergy for alcohol, how it presents in me from the very first time I drank is this. The first drink always does one thing. It asks for the second. The second insists on the third. The third demands the fourth. And the more alcohol in my body, the more I want more alcohol in my body. It's like a snake chasing its tail. It's nasty. And what would have to happen to me is I'd have to be separated from the alcohol somehow, or I would drink to unconsciousness. And that's one third of step one. The second third is the obsession of the mind, the strange mental blank spot, the swearing to God that today is the day I am going to quit for good, and then being drunk that afternoon. That's the obsession of the mind. That's the powerlessness. That's lack of power, choice, and control. Now, the third part of step one is after the dash, that our lives had become unmanageable, right? Well, when I first walked in, yeah, my life was unmanageable. I'd crashing cars and families leaving me and bosses yelling at me and, you know, projectile vomiting and, you know, parking on the neighbor's lawn. I mean, all that stuff. Yeah, my life is really unmanageable. That's not really what they're talking about. Non-alcoholics that drink that much alcohol park on the neighbor's lawn, too. They get DUIs, too. They get sick, too. Hell, they can even blow their liver out, you know, drinking, non-alcoholics. But the thing that I believe is different for us is the spiritual malady. The bondage of self. And what did that look like with me? This is the way it looked with me. On a good day, restless, irritable, and discontented. Without booze, I'm talking about, but without booze. Restless, irritable, and discontented. On a normal day, prey to misery, depression, self-centered, fear, anxiety, shame, guilt, remorse, emotional, just overwhelming emotional pain. Right? That's a normal day. On a bad day, it's the hideous four horsemen. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Suicidal ideation. I mean, we're 60 times more likely to take our own life than non-alcoholics. I mean, that's how bad it gets. You all know. You know, you've been there. Just how lonely and pathetic and torturous that the existence is. And And that's the untreated alcoholism. That's the unmanageability of alcoholism. It's an inner unmanageability. It's a spiritual and an emotional unmanageability. I'll tell this one story because it's a good descriptor. I would get up in the morning. I'd come to in the morning wearing the clothes I'd passed out in the night before. I used to sit at a desk and drink. And what would happen is I would drink to unconsciousness. I'd fall off of my chair. I'd slam down onto the hardwood floor and lump my head up every single night, right? Kaboom! You know, and then I'd come to about 4 hours later and like try to, struggle to bed, right? And I'm about a year into AA and somebody asked me, Kristen, you ever think of getting a throw rug? You got a hardwood floor, you're passing out in every night. There's carpeting. Never thought about it. Now I would come to in the morning and I'd stagger into the bathroom and I'd throw some water on my face. I'd vomit, okay, I'm ready. Cause I'm one of these guys that works, I work. Listen, it's insane. A normal person feeling half as bad would be in the emergency room, but I'm going to work. And I go out to my $100 car. I drive off to my bad job with my bad boss. And the whole way there, I'm like shattered. And just saying, today, I swear to God, today, I'm not going to do this again tonight. Oh, I never want to feel like this. And I mean it, right? I mean it. If you'd throw a lie detector on me and say, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? Never, no. I mean, the thing would the needle would go right to true because I meant it with every fiber of my being. Well, about halfway through the day, what would happen is I'd get half a sandwich down, I'd rehydrate, and I'd start to feel just like 5% human. And quitting time is coming. It's like 4 o'clock and I get off at 4:30 and I start thinking, that decision this morning about, never ever drinking again, ever, like ever, that's a pretty strong decision to make. That might be an overreaction. I think what I'll do is I'll modify that. And I modify it so that I stop at the liquor store on the way home and start the whole thing over again. Now, folks, I'm sane in the morning, not wanting to poison myself anymore. By the afternoon, the insanity of alcoholism has returned. And I don't have any power, choice, and control over stopping at the liquor store. It's autopilot. I'm going. And like when I walk into the liquor store, this was my routine. I'd always have a 20. It was Gordon's vodka in the summer months. It was George Dickel bourbon in the cooler months. I knew where they were. The guy would never run out because we had had that conversation. And I would grab my bottle. Okay. I would grab my bottle and I'd go up to the cash register, bottle down, 20 out, give me my change, drop the bottle in a paper bag and I'm out. Right. It was like a routine. I'm out. And as I'm walking out the door with the quart of vodka or the quart of bourbon, I'm like, you know what I mean? Like I'm not even drinking it yet, and it's given me some relief. Now this one day, I'm my routine. I got my bottle, I got my 20, and I'm heading for the cash register. And there's this lady at the cash register, right? She's going, you know what kind of wine goes with tilapia? She's saying this to the guy behind the cash register. I'm like, God damn it. And he goes, oh yeah, there's some marvelous vintages from the California Chablis section, And I'm like, are you kidding me? And then he starts taking her around the liquor store, pointing at goddamn bottles of wine. And I mean, I'm like, hey, are you crazy? I'm like, vodka buyer here. Vodka buyer. Give her a bottle of Gallo. Get her the hell out of here. Get her out of here. I got a problem. I need you to hurry up. I got a problem. I'm sober. Do you understand? It's not the that internal condition. It's that thing that drives me to the alcohol. You know, it drives me to this alcohol. So I understand all this stuff today. A lot of stuff I didn't understand when I first came in. Now, step two, you know, come to believe that there's a power, you know, that can restore me to sanity. Sanity, meaning power, choice, and control. Meaning I can make an actual decision to stay away from alcohol and it'll work. You know, that's sanity. Insanity is swearing off alcohol in the morning and being drunk in the afternoon. There's a power that can restore that sanity. And when I first walked into AA, I kind of hoped there was something going on in AA that was going to help, right? Because there's all these sober people. They can't all be liars. Most of them are. I can tell, you know, hypocrisy galore. But some of them got to be telling the truth that they actually were alcoholic and, you know, they're not drinking anymore. So there's got to be something going on here. So that was my first, like, it's my first attempt at, you know, step two, that maybe there's a power somewhere available. I don't know what to do, but there's something available in here. And what I did was, because of the willingness that was born of desperation, I did stupid things that weren't going to work for me because you told me to. I'll say that again. I did stupid things that weren't going to work for me because you told me to. And the only reason I did that is because the willingness was born out of desperation. So I got a sponsor. What the hell do I need a sponsor for? I'm not going to find one smarter than me. You know what I mean? God, this is the land of the lame. You know? I can't even believe I'm here. You know, kill me now. Alcoholics Anonymous, church basement. Are you kidding me? You know? But I got one. I got a home group. Why? You know, a home group? Oh, how cute. That's like, you know, like the Rotary Club or something, you know? No, you know, I'm not handing out pamphlets for you at the train station. You know, but I'll join your home group. So I started to do these things that I had figured out weren't going to work for me and I thought were real stupid, but I did it just to be compliant. Just to be compliant with what was being asked of me. And I know that that was the grace of God. You know, I don't think we can do anything. I don't think we can take a breath in here without the grace of God. But I came in and I started to do all these stupid things. So I went from believing that maybe there's some stuff going on in Alcoholics Anonymous that's going to help me. Then I started to think, yeah, there's some stuff in these rooms that really seems to be working. Yeah, you know, so every day that went by, I started to feel stronger about there might be an answer in here. You know, and then, you know, I started to get to know my sponsor really well, Fish Food Phil. And Fish Food Phil, he was so brilliant. He would say things like, you know, I'd go, Phil, I'm going to kill that son of a bitch. And he would go, Chris, we don't kill people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd be like, oh, whoa, you know, we don't kill people. All right, that's probably good, you know. And so I started to like trust this guy, and he started to become a power greater than me because he had been sober 10 years and he was so kind and so compassionate. I was so shattered. You know, he recognized my sensitive alcoholic feelings and really tried not to hurt him. You know, and he'd be, well, you know, Chris, you know, you probably shouldn't date her, you know. You know, he'd give me like this great, it was just a mess. So it went from the group to my sponsor, Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And then I started to believe that there is a power. And, you know, you can call it God, you can call it whatever, but there's a spiritual power that we can gain access to that will work in us and through us. And every day that went by, I started to believe just a little bit more that I could gain access to this power, which would keep me safe and protected from alcohol and help me to just like start to go in the right direction and stop shooting myself in the foot. And I really started to believe in that. You know, my first experience with step three was it's a decision. Step three is a decision. And the way I saw it was the decision to grow the relationship I had with this power or God, to broaden and deepen that relationship. But it was also a decision to take the rest of the steps. Because anybody in here, anybody, you know, like you're going through a hard time and somebody tell you, kid, turn it over. You know, you ever ask, like, what the hell? How do you turn it over? Well, I believe that you turn it over with steps 4 through 9. I think that's a super way to turn anything over, you know? And so in step 3, I made a decision to engage in the rest of these steps and to broaden and deepen this relationship with God. God was going to be the father. God was going to be the principal. You know, I'm going to be the child. God's going to be the director. Okay. God's going to be the director. I am going to quit playing God. Now that's something, folks, it's going to take me an entire lifetime to quit playing God. Cause I always know what's better for you. You know what I mean? And to not play God is to just shut up about it. You know, you may know, but don't offer that up, especially at Thanksgiving dinner. You know, what everybody should be doing. So I got to quit playing God. I got to move forward with these steps. Now, here's a couple of lessons I learned, from step 4. I don't know about, I can't see this clock. How much time do we got? 15 minutes. I don't know about anybody else, but you ever get resentments at home about home groups or AA meetings or people in the meetings? You know. So my first home group, there's a group of older people that sit around a coffee pot. I mean, they were the old timers. You know, I'm talking like 1990. So these were people that got sober in the 20s, you know, and they were sitting around the coffee pot and they didn't want anything to do with me. And then there were some younger people. I was like 34 maybe, but there was some people in their 20s and there was a bunch of halfway houses and rehabs and they just seemed like they were all friends. And I was somewhere in the middle. I didn't fit in and I felt like this isn't working for me. And I got a resentment against the home group. I'm there about 6 months, 8 months. And, you know, I'm out of here, you know. I don't need these people. The hell with these people. Now, the one smart thing I did was I joined another home group. And this home group was, you know, 10 miles away from that one. And it had people right around my age. And I clicked in. I clicked in really quickly with them. And I made friends. And we would go to the torturously uncomfortable sober dances together. And we'd go out to the diner and do all this stuff. And we really became friends. And it was a good home group for me to be in. And then the slow, painful, root canal-esque business meetings started in the group. Okay. Picture is about 80 people in this home group on a Tuesday and a Friday night. Well, what happened was there was a guy who would come Friday night. That was the speaker meeting, but wouldn't come Tuesday. And they wouldn't give a treasure. They'd give the treasure report on Tuesday. They wouldn't bother the speaker meeting with it, right? And this guy he'd read the traditions or something, and he was just really pissed off. He started calling these group conscious meetings, and it was a very immature group. There was not a lot of recovery in the group. There was a lot of sobriety, but there wasn't a lot of recovery. And what happened was these group consciences were bloodbaths. They were bloodbaths. And after every one of them, you would have lost 50% of the group. We went from like 80 people down to like 8. I mean, and it was because this one guy wanted to know what the hell you were doing with his dollar. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, think about it. So finally, I'm like one of the last of the waves of people to go. I'm out of here. You know, this group sucks. And the only thing I did right was I joined another home group, okay? I joined the Somerset Hills High Bottom group. And this is a weird group. There was like an airline pilot, brain surgeon, money market guy, lawyer, and Chris. I mean, it was nuts. But here's what happened in the meantime. I had done a four-step. I had done a four-column resentment inventory, and I had shared it with my sponsor. So what happened was I resented myself out of one group. I resented myself out of another group. But then I went through the steps, and guess what? I stayed in that stupid group for like 20-some years because of the power of the resentment inventory. Now, every single time I left a home group, it would be like leaving your iron lung. You know what I mean? Like leaving your dialysis treatment behind. Like think about that. You know, it's what's keeping me connected and alive. It's insane. But so I finally went through that resentment inventory and I was able to stay. I was able to stay here because of that. The fear inventory. I always had an enormous amount of anxiety, and you know, like social phobia. You know, anxiety about talking to more than two or three people at the same time. And did the fear inventory. You know, really looked at that, and then I heard a tape. And in this tape, the person said something like this. I'm trying to remember it so long ago, but you're taking the steps. You're making a decision to try to do what God would have you do, to try to be of service to God, to try to help God's other children. What is God going to let get through to you that isn't somehow in your best interest? And it clicked with me. It clicked with me. This anxiety and this fear that I had, it was because I was running the show. I was the one making all the decisions. And it was all on me. And it's not all on me. You know what I mean? I'm in charge of the actions. I'm not in charge of the outcome. And I started to outgrow fear using this inventory. And then there's the conduct inventory, the sex conduct inventory. Instinctually, we're all programmed to procreate and to couple up and to be tribal. And, you know, it's instinctual in us. And it's God-given and it's good because it keeps mankind on the planet, you know. But what happens with alcoholics, and what certainly happened with me, is I started to use this selfishly. I started to be very, very selfish where it concerned girlfriends and wives and these relationships. I became very domineering and very controlling, and they always blew up like the Hindenburg. You know what I mean? It was just really, really bad. And here I am, I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I find, God's will for me, you know, I'm doing all this good stuff and, you know, God's rewarding me with this girl. You know, I'm like sober 12 months or so. Oh, two ding-a-lings do not make a bell. I learned that one very, very the hard way. Anyway, and it was monstrous debacle, you know. In the meantime, I do this inventory. You know, the nine questions, the review of the relationship, what should I have done instead? Who did I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness? You know, all those questions. And I got really thorough about answering all these old relationships. And I started to see what the hell was going on. The problem was me. The problem was I used to think they always leave me when I need them most. Right?
Yeah.
I get to the other side of the inventory and it's like they were insane to stay as long as they did. You know? I mean, it was a complete shift in perception. And so, you make a sex ideal, you ask God to help mold you toward that ideal, and you get about the business of making amends, and, you know, what happens is you change. There's fundamental changes that go on. We start to be less selfish. We start to care more sometimes for the welfare of others than for our own. And this is a new ball game, you know, because I believe what alcoholism is it's chronic and toxic selfishness and self-centeredness. That's what alcoholism is. And the pain of being that toxically selfish and self-centered creates that emotional bondage of self that we need to pour alcohol on to be able to tolerate. And then it's out of our control. So these inventories allowed me to move past some really self-destructive behavior. Behavior that was going to kill me. Step six. I think step six is a monster. Step six is a monster. You know, become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Now, you can become willing in about 3 seconds, and then you can move on to the seven-step prayer, right? But the fact of the matter is step six is everything. Step six is becoming willing to grow toward God's ideal and to enlist the power of God in helping to recreate our lives and to overcome our character defects and to be what God would have us be. And being willing to be on that playing field. To be willing to be on that playing field. And then step seven, ask God, please, please remove these defects of character. Why? Why? Because these defects of character are my alcoholism. My alcoholism is my defects of character, and they're too big for me. And my ego would like me to think I just need to try a little bit harder. Or I got it this time. No. These defects of character are so deeply embedded in my nature, the only thing that's going to pry them loose is the power of God working in me and through me. And I need to ask God to relieve me of this bondage of self and these character defects. Then I move to step eight. I need to take responsibility for the wrongs and the mistakes I've made in my life. I have to take the reason I need to take responsibility is that's how I grow. So I need to become willing to make amends to the people and the institutions that I've harmed, and I need to actually go and make amends to the people and the institutions that I've harmed. And it's through those ego deflating exercises that humility can come in and a better perspective on what this world really is. There was a great speaker. He came out of Southern California and he was legendary because he changed the way people spoke in AA. His name was Chuck C. And up until Chuck C's time, people told drunkalogs, crash a lot of cars, and that's really what was going on. And he started to do these spiritual talks. And it was revolutionary at this time, and he started to talk about God and spirituality and things that you just weren't hearing in the meetings. And he would have a whiteboard, and picture this. He would draw a giant big circle on this whiteboard, and he would say, within that circle is absolutely everything in the universe. It's the stars, it's the planets, absolutely everything in the universe is within that circle. And then he would put a little dot right outside the circle. And he would say, that's the alcoholic. Because we're outside of everything. And it's our perception that we're outside of everything. We're really inside everything. But we think we're out there, we're on our own. You know, so what we do is we make amends to the people and the institutions that we've harmed. that changes us so fundamentally. You've all heard the promises. You know, we'll not regret the past nor wish to shut the door. Although those are nice set promises. Those come true when you're out there making amends. Step 10 is doing all these things in a reactive way. It's practicing these principles in all of our affairs. Whatever we can do, whatever spiritual lessons we've learned or practices we've developed, to apply them where appropriate. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation. I love step 11. Bill opens the door so wide in step 11. He tells us we need to do upon awakening, moving through the day, and when we retire at night. So those are three specific exercises that we must become disciplined with, or that's what the 11th step is. But he said that there's also, the 11th step is also 400 miles deep. You know, go get some books. Go back to your religion of choice. You know, go to India. You know, just do a lot of praying. Do, you know, seek. Become a seeker. And that really is one of the most amazing things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love step 11. Today, this year, I do more prayer and meditation than I did last year. And it's not because of any sense of virtue. I find a lot of connectedness in it, and I find a lot of comfort in it. And that's really why I do it. It focuses me, and it clears up my perception on what this whole thing really is about, this world. And step 12, carry this message to other alcoholics. Practice these principles in all of our affairs. We have an awakened spirit. Our spirit has been awakened through these steps. We are now awake. We're not perfect, you know. A spiritual awakening does not mean you're going to be a perfect person, unfortunately. But what it will do is it ensures you that you'll at least be awake for it, you know. Trust me, for years I was living in a dream, stumbling around thinking I was awake and I was asleep. Because when you have this spiritual awakening, you start to understand what this whole thing really is about. And you start to gain compassion and charity to the people you used to think were blockheads. You know, you want the newcomers to stay sober. You want to go to the treatment centers and help people and carry the message. You want to help your family. You want to help your community. It's a complete shift in personality. I couldn't have cared less about anybody when I was drinking. Today I'm involved in so many damn things, it's ridiculous, around the community and with my job and board. I'm a board of directors of a couple of things. It's nuts. But practically every waking moment of my life is trying to figure out how to be helpful. That's not me. That's the power of God. And the ability to change a selfish, pathetic alcoholic into someone who actually gives a damn about some stuff. And I cannot tell you how grateful I am to be here tonight and have the opportunity to share this message. Thank you a lot.